The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you've ever visited Prescott Park in Portsmouth, maybe you've walked out to the pier overlooking the Piscataqua River and seen the plaque that says,
"From here, you can see the tide turn like a door on its hinges. We're just going out. Do you want anything from the ocean?"
That is the voice of Robert Dunn reading his poem, "From Here You Can See." Dunn was Portsmouth's Poet Laureate from 1999 to 2001. He was both a fixture and an enigma, often seen walking the streets of the town long before the chic shops and eateries moved in. The writer Catherine Towler moved to Portsmouth when it was still a little rough-edged and was intrigued by Dunn, who rented a single room without an electrical outlet and sold hand-bound collections of his poems for a penny. Her book, The Penny Poet of Portsmouth, recounts their unfolding relationship as her life and the seaside town transformed. We spoke to her when the book was first released last year. It is now out in paperback.
So you first saw Robert Dunn there kind of shambling along the streets, brushing by you with barely an acknowledgement at one point. You assumed he was homeless, but he wasn't. Who was he and how did he live?
So Robert was a poet, and that was the primary focus of his life, was his writing. And he read a great deal. He was one of the most widely read people I have ever met. And he worked a few hours each afternoon at the Portsmouth Athenaeum. And, well, I saw him first on the streets when I moved to Portsmouth, as you describe. And then I met him as my neighbor. I discovered that he lived next door to me, where he had the single room in the house he rented. And through meeting him as my neighbor and then also as a fellow writer, that I got to know him a little bit. He was a hard person to get to know.
You write about him seeming to you so much like a person from another century and this town from another century. And there's a lot of connection about people and place here in your book. You're both living in this scrappy, you know, somewhat rundown town as it was becoming gentrified. The J.J. Newbery's closes, becomes a Gap. The A&P closes. But he was, as you came to find out, quite treasured in this town. Why?
He was a person who put his art first. He put his poetry first, and I think people admired that. And people knew him because he didn't have a car. He walked everywhere. So he was someone you saw almost daily walking around town. He was someone people simply knew as part of the streetscape of Portsmouth, and he had a wonderful wit. He was very, very funny. Very smart, a brilliant mind, and people admired him for leading a very alternative life and for writing his wonderful poems, which he shared at poetry readings and in his little penny books, which he sewed by hand. And he would sell them on the street in Market Square. If you happened to run into him and he had a new book, he would pull it out of the pocket of his trench coat, which he always wore. He was famous for that trench coat and his flat cap.
And I think you tried to give him, what, a dollar once for one of his penny books?
Well, when he had a new penny book, and I ran into him in Market Square, and he took it out of his pocket, and he said, "I have that book for you." And I didn't realize at first which book. And then I realized, oh, it's his new little penny book, which I had been eagerly waiting for and looking forward to. And I tried to give him, I think I tried to give him $5, and he refused that. Anyway, he finally, I think, did end up taking a dollar from me.
He was the kind of guy that gave the town character on some level, but really inscrutable in some ways. But you did get to know him in at least a tentative way. Why was that so surprising to you?
I was surprised, I guess, because at the end of his life, Robert was quite ill. And he was ill for 3 years, in and out of the hospital and the rehab unit at the assisted living facility. And he turned to me and in some ways almost appointed me as his next of kin, the person who the doctors and the social workers had authorization to talk to or to call in an emergency. And I puzzled over why me. So I guess that was what was surprising me. He was such a private person. He wasn't that easy to get to know, and yet he did open up to me to a degree in those last years.
Well, this is a man who never appeared to need friends. I mean, certainly didn't want charity from anybody or even health insurance from his employers at the Athenaeum. But he was a heavy smoker, had some pulmonary troubles, emphysema. And this failing health kind of increased this vulnerability that vanished, that careful distance he had. I think you call it the silent insistence that the world came to him. There's a real power in that, isn't there, in that kind of remove?
Oh, sure. There's a great power in it. And Robert sort of dictated the terms on which he would open up to people, and he dictated the terms in which he would share his writing. So he was not like many writers looking for fame. He did not care that much about how his work was published. He wanted to connect with readers. And so he did remain an enigmatic person, and there is a sort of power in that, you know? He controlled how people knew him and what they knew about him.
That kind of leads us to another, I think, really powerful theme in the book. There's this tension in your own life as you tried to stick to your writing while now married, you know, learning how to be married, now a member of a community. Could you read a bit from the book about that?
Well, this is from chapter 11, and it's after Robert has become sick, and so he's not able to walk around town as much. And at the beginning of this chapter, I'm walking into town on a December evening, and I'm thinking about how Robert is missing on the streets of Portsmouth and how I am missing seeing him there. There's an irony in our looking to someone like Robert, who deliberately defined himself outside the mainstream of human life, to tell us about the living of that life. This person watching from the sidelines should, it seems, be the least qualified to illuminate our experience, but this is what we ask of writers. The ones who produce the most lasting books are often ruthless at separating themselves from the world. In this riddle lies the uncertainty at the heart of the writer's work. We have no right to make claims for the rest of our human brothers and sisters, but this is precisely what we do. We plant a flag at the summit of human experience. We assert that though we might be quiet, watchful types prone to lurking in corners, we have some insight into the lives of our more active neighbors that gives us the license to tell their stories. Solitude is not a recipe by itself for good writing, nor does good writing necessarily require solitude. But often when these elements come together at the highest levels, something sublime occurs. Robert is a good example. He was beloved as a poet among those who knew his work in New Hampshire and beyond because he had his finger on the pulse of a few significant truths and translated them into language that, though the voice might have been quirky and unpredictable, was instantly recognizable as our own common language. He stood outside the world while giving it back to us whole.
That's Catherine Towler reading from The Penny Poet of Portsmouth. This is her memoir, charting her unfolding relationship with the poet Robert Dunn. It's an elegy of sorts to an eccentric poet and for the town, which inspired and ultimately took care of him. He died in 2008. Well, Robert was reclusive, seemed not to care about the success and the recognition and the material trappings of fame, which made you, you're writing and publishing three novels, you're going out on book tours, feel somewhat suspect in his eyes. Now, what did that mean for you?
He was a challenge. You know, the way Robert lived his life with such incredible integrity was a challenge, I think, to anyone, but particularly to me as a writer. He made me think about what was most important and why was I writing? What was it I most wanted? So did fame come first or did the writing come first? He put the writing first. He wasn't doing it to get recognition from others. He was doing it for the pure art of it. And that was why I felt sometimes that he was observing me and how caught up I was in caring about what others thought of my writing and trying to, impress other people with my work instead of simply focusing on the work itself and doing the work that I needed to be doing without thought of how it would be received.
But it seems like you observed a cost in being that single-minded about your work, too.
I did. So for me, the process of writing the book was coming to understand my own admiration for Robert. I had admired him so much in the first years when I knew him, and I held him up as an ideal. But when he became sick, I saw the cost of that kind of single-minded devotion. I saw the cost of how he had lived financially on so little. He did not have a family. He did not have a partner. And he was very alone at the end of his life, at a time when he needed other people. And so it made me reevaluate my admiration of him and think about that ideal of, you know, the single-minded devotion to your art. And it made me appreciate perhaps the more complex nature of my life, the fact that I had gotten married and had a life that was more full of people than his life.
Do you think he really didn't care if anyone read his poems, if they were recognized?
No, I think he did care. He wanted his poems to be read by people. He wanted to share them, and he found ways to do that. But he made, in some ways, a calculated choice to do that in the small scale in New Hampshire and Portsmouth, and not to get caught up in trying to gain recognition more widely.
I think there's a point in the book where you reflect on buying your home with your husband and think, like, we got in at just the right time, right? Before all the property values skyrocketed and, you know, the upscale chain stores had moved in. And I couldn't help but wonder if his life was perfectly timed for that place. You know, would it be possible for a writer to live as he did so close to the bone in today's Portsmouth?
No, it wouldn't be possible. His rental situation, renting a single room in a house within walking distance of downtown today, I think would be virtually impossible to find a place that was that affordable. And you're right, it was an accident of time for him as well, that he came to Portsmouth when he did, when it was a place where you could live more reasonably. It had not been as discovered and gentrified and developed as it has been today.
Just in closing, I'm thinking of that sort of hunger for, you know, fame, recognition. Knowing this, going through the process of reflecting on Robert's life and the community that he had around him or didn't have around him, how do you look at that sort of quest or hunger for success now?
Well, I think my view of it is also tempered by being older and realizing that success in the eyes of the wider world can be very fleeting. It can be satisfying, but not something that will lead to long-term contentment or happiness. And so I think I have made a greater peace in my own mind with trying to be a bit more like Robert. I'm not quite like him, but trying to be a bit more like him in focusing on the work and trying to make the work of the highest quality I can make it. Obviously, I want to get published, and I want my work to go out into the world, but trying to stay very focused on the work itself in doing that.
Well, Catherine Towler, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us about it.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
That's my earlier conversation with Catherine Towler. Her latest book is The Penny Poet of Portsmouth, and it's now out in paperback.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
We've been talking 3 hours and I think it's going well.
And it's time for our final update on the RPM Challenge. If you missed our earlier segments, RPM stands for Record Production Month, where musicians and bands try to record 10 songs or 35 minutes worth of new material in just a month.
The event, which just wrapped up its 12th year, got its start in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is where we found Rob R.C. Thomas, who we followed as he scrambled to write and record and mix and master a brand new album in just 28 days.
The truth comes out. Finally figured out what I was talking about.
Well, February is over, and Rob is here now for a final debrief on how it all went. Rob R.C. Thomas, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us, Rob's longtime friend and collaborator, Dan Walker. He also worked on the album. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
So we haven't heard from you since just before the deadline, right? What did you end up naming the album?
We named it Homestead Volume 1. Just seemed the simplest and easiest thing to go with. And we're big Led Zeppelin fans, too. So
it worked.
Can't go wrong with numbering an album, you know.
So let's hear a finished song. This one is pretty appropriate for the RPM Challenge. It is called Out of Time.
Get up. You're out of time. All that flow needs my bed. Get up. You're out of time. All that dish needs washing. Get up. You're out of time. All that mud needs dropping. Get up. Another day, another place. Lord, you gotta hold your head up high. So
Rob, how is writing for RPM different from writing music the rest of the time?
It's different because you're on a severe time crunch, first and foremost. So it forces you to not think too much. Really, just if something sounds pretty good or even great, hey, you know, just go with it and do the best you can. Yeah, I feel like it's a awesome exercise in time management.
I'm thinking of, who is it that said, the perfect is the enemy of the good.
Yes. Yeah.
You have no time to be a perfectionist.
And I feel like that does actually helps the process in some ways, because you really don't get stuck on something. You know?
I think it was Voltaire, by the way, for credit's sake. But any part of that, is it music, lyrics, melody, you know, like any part of that you normally get stuck on?
Yes, I think lyrics would definitely be something you would get stuck on more often. To 99% of people, that's what they're hearing and paying attention to. So there's a temptation to go back and make it perfect, whatnot. So that actually, the song, like Between Us, that song, I wrote those lyrics in 5 minutes. And you know what? They're really good. Like, I mean, they're not perfect, but on to the next.
Well, it's here. What's next? My Hometown is another song from the record.
Time always finds a way to even things out. Problems to the smallest doubts. Didn't think much when I left this town, but you know it's where it all went down. Doesn't have the bustle of a New York City, always had a way of keeping me busy. Drunken teachers, schoolyard fights, hiding from the cars on a Friday night, drinking on the tracks from your father's stash.
So, Dan, you were smiling when this song first started playing. Why is that?
I think this one we were writing the lyrics to in the 11th hour.
Yes, this one, Between Us and...
Street with a View.
Street with a View, that's it. Yeah. That's
Did you do 10 songs exactly?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Like no more.
Yeah.
But you also watched these evolve. I mean, we heard them evolve a little bit through listening to Taylor's Diary with you. How does it feel to hear it now after the end of this evolution?
It feels good. Honestly, I mean, it was nice to take a break from the recordings and then come back to it. I think you waited, Dan waited like almost a week.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you wait, Dan?
Burnout. We had listened to these songs.
Too close
so many,
to it.
Absolutely. You know, the amount of time that we spent in the studio together, it was incredible. Fortunately, we had the time to do it. I think a lot of musicians that are doing the RPM Challenge didn't have the time that we did or the facilities that we do. So we were very fortunate. But it was just absolute burnout.
Well, I love that it's called Homestead Studios because I think of this, the songs that I listen to, except for one, I think it's pretty cohesive. There's this kind of sense of small town themes. Was that a happy accident or was that something you really were going for?
I think it just kind of happened naturally, really. I mean, some songs I came in with a general idea about it and some I think a lot of them that became more nostalgic or hometown based was we'd put our heads together and some of that would come out just because of the history. You know, we grew up in the same hometown, known each other since the third grade. So there's a lot of fun memories and some bad ones, you know. So kind of all, some of that stuff came up when we started writing together.
So here's some of the things I learned listening to this process, that if you're doing a pop country song, ain't has to be in it somewhere.
It's, I don't know if it's technically a rule, but I, you know, in case it was, I thought I'd throw it in.
That when a songwriter doesn't know the words, sometimes they use meow. Meow, 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 meow.
Solid advice.
And don't ever play your disco track in front of a radio producer if you don't want it on the radio.
I like that track, so if it made it on the radio, so be it.
Any other big takeaways?
It was great to collaborate. My last 2 years have been solo completely, and they are good, solid efforts, but it was more enjoyable across the board to work with another person. That would be my advice to future RPM folks that are thinking about doing it. That adds to the experience.
What are you guys going to do with it? What are you going to do with the songs afterwards?
I think we're going to go back and see what may need to be reworked. We might try re-recording entire tracks if we feel like it, and then be much easier because at least the songs are done.
Do you guys have a favorite song out of the whole thing?
There's a few that are very personal to me. Feel to Believe is definitely very personal. I forget the names of these songs because we had working titles.
Working titles. Feel to Believe was SOS.
No, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't SOS.
No.
It was
Doodle.
Doodle.
Are you guys going to fight?
Perhaps.
Bicker will at worst, I promise.
But I would say, I mean, my personal favorite is Feel to Believe, without a doubt.
Well, let's hear that, Feel to Believe.
Conversation like a warning. You'll understand, you'll see. It's like trying to explain the ocean. You just gotta dip your feet. Different level of devotion, right in here with me. Trying to relax, nerves are wrecked, feeling that relief. Bags are packed, got one in the back, it's coming on a home with me. Finally relaxed, good to be back.
Well, so part of the idea here was that you were going to kind of get your yayas out before your baby's due in May. You going to do this again?
Oh, yeah. I love doing RPM. That's great.
Dan Yen?
If I have time, absolutely. I'd love to do it again.
That is Dan Walker. He is the owner of Homestead Studios in Sandown, New Hampshire, and a longtime collaborator with Rob Thomas. Dan, thank you so much for coming this way.
Thank you for having us.
And Rob R.C. Thomas, he's a professional musician. He's based on the Seacoast and one of hundreds of musicians to complete the RPM Challenge. Rob, thanks so much, and all the best to you and your new family.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
He's all out on his own now. Proud of the man he's come to be. Here's a past, don't look back. Oh, so hard to see. My boy's all grown and he's coming home. Coming on home to me.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And it's time for The Bookshelf. This time, host Peter Biello is tackling a bit of poetry. But no ordinary collection. I'll just let him take it from here.
When you're talking about form poetry, the rules for the Japanese haiku are pretty simple. In a traditional haiku, you've got 17 syllables, a line of 5, a line of 7, and then another line of 5. Usually, the haiku hones in on details of the natural world and does so with a light touch. In his new book, Like Water, Lebanon author Kaisalim Montas offers us Japanese haiku that he wrote in his native Spanish that have now been translated into English. And he joins me now to talk about his book. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It is actually my pleasure.
So this is a fascinating book because, first of all, the haikus are Japanese. That's a Japanese form. You wrote them in Spanish. and now they are in English. They've been translated into English. Tell me about the process of turning these poems that were originally written in Spanish into English. You had a translator, and I assume you were working with them.
Correct. So the idea behind doing that is sort of exposing myself to the English-speaking market, if you will. But at the same time, it's a fascinating process to do translation. So when I first proposed it to the translator, she was like, haiku, that's kind of difficult. I said, well, let me send you the book. I sent her the book, and she looked at it, and she got back to me and said, let's do this. And then we began working. She did the whole translation, and then we met and began going over the poems one by one, see what sounded right, what worked, what didn't work. After that, of course, there was a process of editing and changing and suggesting. So translation is fascinating, I will say.
Especially difficult when it's such a rigid form, right? The haiku has, you followed the traditional model, which is there are three lines, and there are 17 syllables total, and they go 5-7-5.
Correct.
And as was stated in one of the forewords here in this book, is that sometimes the English-Spanish equivalents have different syllables, so the translation gets a little messy there.
Yes, it does. And then you have to look for different words, make sure that they don't stray too far from the original meaning. Sometimes you have to add something here and there that might add an emphasis, because you want to stay sort of loyal to that original, but it is challenging.
Well, what draws you to the form of haiku?
In general, I'm attracted to Japanese culture, Japanese woodworking, and Japanese poetry. And the haiku has that attraction of being that such a restrictive form, yet at the same time, you try to capture something that is really, really profound, a reflection of a particular moment. And if you stick to the guidelines, it's like, to accomplish something that you feel great about is a great sense of accomplishment within that restrained form, if you will.
Mm-hmm. The rules almost make it more fun to write.
In a way, I think I usually think of rules and I think of democracy. I think one of the great things about having certain rules that they are known and everybody sees them is that everybody has to play fair. Doing great and having fun within the rules is awesome.
So if you see a haiku that doesn't follow the rules but pulls off something kind of nice, you'll say, well, but come on, you know, you didn't measure the syllables correctly.
I wouldn't call myself a stricter in that sense. But when I write, I prefer to stick to the rules. But again, people are experimenting with different things. And I have seen things that I wouldn't dare call them haiku, but if they do, I respect them.
Okay, all right. And one of the rules that you followed here, too, is that you made use of season words, at least one in each poem. Describe what you mean by that.
Season word is to sort of allude to what the season of the year is within the poem. And that has a particular attraction to me because I come from the Caribbean. Seasons there are pretty much one.
Summer, perpetual summer.
Summer, perpetual summer. And then coming here to New England and having a beautiful backyard, I have sort of been able to appreciate from my window at my writing table, looking outdoors and see the changing of the seasons, extreme beauty. So that's also been an inspiration, I will say, for the writing of the book. And therefore, haiku that has that as part of its rules, if you will, it sort of eases that transition for the appreciation of nature and then putting that into my work.
Well, I think we've gone too long without hearing one. So is there one in this collection, Like Water, that you feel comfortable or would like to share?
Sure. There is one particular poem because I just spoke to a friend about what is happening right now with the melting of snow that I thought that I read. This poem says, crystal fluid state in the purring sound that flows en route to April.
Traditionally, poems, not just that one, but many in this book, tend to be about nature. For me, the ones I enjoyed the most were the ones that most successfully almost humanized the landscape. Is that something that you were going for?
I'm glad that you feel that way because I wasn't necessarily consciously going for that, but I was actually trying to make that connection between what I was seeing and my own relationship with nature. So if you are feeling that, I'm going to put a feather on my shoulder or on my hat for that one.
And some of these poems towards the end especially are poems that I think any writer out there would certainly appreciate. Today, without words, it's impossible to live as without water.
I think words are and language is what sort of the greatest human quality that we have. It's what makes us human. And then water, if I were to make an expression or give an example of what God is, I would say that God is water. It is the power of nature. It's the only element that you could see as a gas, as a solid, as a liquid. When you see now the spring, when you see the brooks or the rivers just roaring with that power, we see storms. And yet, we humans depend on water, and when we look for signs of life anywhere, say, if there's water, there's life. So to me, as a writer and as a human being, words are as essential for my existence as is water.
Well, Casey, thank you very much for coming in and speaking to me about your book.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
That's Casey Lim Montas, also known as Casey Montas, and he's the author of the new collection of haiku, Like Water. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Casey's bookshelf at nhpr.org.
Peter Biello there, host of The Bookshelf. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, Jazar and Delay. There's loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Check it out. I'm Virginia Prescott. We will be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.